From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for July 12th, 2019. Checking the calendar, it's time for baguettes and beignets. It's Bastille Days this weekend in downtown Milwaukee. This Sunday, Diana Ross is at the Riverside Theater. Also this weekend, it's the 100th anniversary of the West Allis Farmers Market, and the Brewers host the San Francisco Giants. Gender reveal parties announcing the sex of the baby are all the rage, and apparently, gender reveal burnouts are all of the rage, too. Cars smoke their tires and emit clouds of pink or blue smoke. You just know this got started in the South. Okay, think about this for a second. The Nevada State Patrol pulled over and ticketed a hearse for driving in the high occupancy lane. And finally, this is kind of disgusting. In Texas, the latest online challenge is go to Walmart, open a container of ice cream, lick the ice cream, and then put it back. Walmart's solution to this stupid stunt is to hire armed guards to protect the ice cream. Okay, boys, set your tasers on stun. In the studio today, we have Brian Kilb, Kyle Tedding, Steve Giles, Joel Dreesang, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Thanks, Max. Pretty good week. NASDAQ set a record up 1% this week, adding 82 points to close at 82.54, all-time high for the NASDAQ. S&P 500 finally closed above 3,000 for the week, tacking on 23 points, up 0.8%. Dow Jones Industrial Average up 410 points this week, 1.5% advance. We closed at the bell this afternoon in New York with the Dow finishing the week at 27,332 on Thursday, first time the Dow ever crossed and closed above 27,000. Year-to-date, NASDAQ's up a stellar 25% with dividends, S&P 500 up 21.5%, and the Dow up 18.7%. You know, Kyle, let's talk about a week ago, the Labor Department came out with a pretty good jobs report. Market sold off, spilled into Monday of this week with stocks continuing to sell off on this idea that good news is bad news. Good news that a lot of people found employment. Bad news is it might be less likely that the Fed was going to lower interest rates. And then Fed Chair Jay Powell testified in front of Congress this week saying, in his exact words, it appears, I quote, that uncertainties around trade tensions and concerns about the strength of the global economy continue to weigh on the U.S. economic outlook, which in English everybody took to mean that he's going to be lowering rates at the end of July. And then the market took off after that, as you know. Wednesday up 76 points, Thursday up 227, and today the markets are up 244 points. So good news meant the stock sold off. And then the bad news that we saw this week was translated into good news, and stocks went to record highs.
Yeah, it's such an interesting pattern that we're back into now. You know, it's been a couple of years since we've really had that conversation about good news being bad and bad news being good. But really, with the Fed in focus now, with it becoming increasingly obvious that, you know, the Fed is ready to move. You know, I think the one catch here is that there's some concern about how much space they have. The last time we cut rates, we were coming from, you know, over 5% down to zero, and now, you know, we don't have that kind of room to cut. And so, you know, should we run into some kind of economic issue, the Fed's got less ammunition now. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how far they're willing to go. You look at what the Fed futures market is pricing in, and they're certainly pricing in the likelihood of at least a couple of cuts. You know, still this year and potentially one or two more next year. But, you know, I think, you know, it'll be the thing that continues to drive the markets as long as it's the thing that runs the news cycle.
You know, not only is the overnight rate at 2.25 to 2.5, so it's impossible to lower 5 percentage points, as you point out, which is what they typically do when we go into a recession. But, you know, I've been reading these reports that suggest that the two areas that are most sensitive to lower interest rates may not respond the way they historically do. Manufacturing and housing. Housing has become more of an affordability issue. Mortgage rates were already very low a couple of years ago. That sending mortgage rates down a tad may not give the housing market enough of an oomph, if you will, enough of a push because of the affordability. So the point is, not only can they not lower 5 full percentage points, but the two areas of the economy that usually give us the lift from lower rates may be less likely to respond the way they historically have.
You know, and I think there is some potential for, you know, the one or two folks on the margin who maybe couldn't afford the house before with a little bit of a cut to be able to afford it now. But, you know, I think you look, you know, more broadly, the people who were going to refinance, the people who were going to purchase, they've already done that. And so, yeah, there's still some folks that might be shopping for new houses. There's still some manufacturers that might need to borrow some money in order to build out their production capacity. But, you know, for the most part, the bulk of that spending has already happened. And so, you know, in addition to not having the room to cut the, you know, the full 5 percentage points that we saw in the past, I don't think we've seen a lot of the spending as well. And so, you know, as we continue to kind of discuss this idea of an economic slowdown, you know, I think that's one of the things we'll have to continue to watch is how the Fed responds.
Brian, as you know, stocks had their best June since 1955. Historically, when the market's up over 15% for the first half of the year, the second half does pretty well. You got to be happy with the results so far.
Well, it's just, you know, you live this stuff every day, Bob, and I still sit and look at these facts at the end of Friday and the NASDAQ up 25, hard to believe, you know. And I think it's, in context of the conversation you and Kyle were just having, so fascinating that we've had this run and we're talking about record highs in both the S&P and the Dow, and we're talking about lowering rates still. You know, it's certainly not something I've been through in my career where you kind of saw the juxtaposition of those two unique things. And then, you know, you kind of look around and you think about the typical recession being caused by housing. Well, that's probably not going to cause it. Or significantly increased costs, that's probably not going to cause it. So, you know, looking ahead to perhaps the end of the cycle and how it may come about, we're in kind of some unusual territory right now. It's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Rob Arnott from Research Affiliates was quoted the other day as saying that the Fed really needs to get going, that the economy is slowing fairly quickly, in his opinion, and that the Fed would not only need to cut interest rates, but they'd have to be bold in their approach. You know, and then you got others that are saying that, no, leave some of the ammunition, some of the powder dry for when the skies get really dark. And I think, Brian, you know, your point is right on the money, because the bond market's telling you that inflation's not a problem and things are going to slow down. The stock market's telling you that things have never been better. And the reality, I think, is somewhere in between there.
You know, I go back to those days when I was back in manufacturing. Banks don't make stuff, you know, and I'm not saying they don't facilitate things or make it easier or make it possible for certain things to happen, but banks don't add value to the process. And I think growing economies are based on value-added propositions out there. And so, you know, I get a little bit nervous when there's so much talk about the Fed greasing the skids for things or making things happen, because that's not the thing that drives, you know, the economy in the long run. So when you look at perhaps things like the lack of productivity or some other issues along those lines, I think that's really maybe what we ought to be focusing on rather than just, you know, what the Fed's doing. And having said that, if interest rates go lower, it's going to be good for stocks, right? So,
Steve, the yield curve's been inverted now for over 30 days. It inverted the third week in May, 3-month yield higher than the 10-year. So according to the Fed, that's a problem.
Yeah, you're right, Bob. And what we're seeing in the bond market is a lot of those more intermediate to longer-term bond total returns starting to creep up this year. Last year, the play obviously was to stay short-term, as we all know. In a rising rate environment, we want our money to come due a little bit sooner so we can re-up at the higher yields. But now, with this anticipation of the Fed lowering rates, you're starting to see the bond market push out those durations, and the more intermediate-term bonds are responding quite favorably now.
Joel, as you know, the Labor Department reported last week a very robust jobs report. And then earlier this week, I read that The workforce participation rates are the lowest since 1977. About 62% of those eligible for work are in the workforce right now. So the robust job numbers don't really adequately explain what's going on.
That's right, Bob. And I thought it was interesting this week that that Chairman Powell was also talking about the low unemployment rate and the fact that it seems to have lost its historical context as far as inflation is concerned. That usually when we see employment as good as it looks right now, that there'd be a push up on wages. And although we've seen some push up on wages, we're not seeing it high enough and long enough that inflation is really being a problem right now.
Well, apparently Fed Chairman Jay Powell listened to our seminar from last September when I spoke rather eloquently about the British economist A.W. Phillips, who 50 years ago coined the term the Phillips curve, where he said that if unemployment falls below 5%, inevitably inflation goes up, although the original Phillips curve tracked wages, not inflation. And it's broken this time around for all sorts of reasons, and I think that creates a problem for the Fed. You know, think that the Fed raised rates 4 times last year. They have to have regretted that at this point in time. You know, I'd be hard-pressed to identify a period in which 7 months later we're going the other way on interest rates. Hardly ever happens. And I'm hard-pressed to think of the last time where there was that small a time frame where they did a 180-degree turn.
So is that because we're more interconnected globally, that that's become a bigger factor in all of this now?
Well, I think that, and I think that the slowdown of the economy has caught the Fed off guard. I mean, if you look at economic growth, it's slowing more rapidly, I think, than the Fed expected. We had huge GDP growth for the first quarter. You know, now they're talking about 1.4% GDP for the second quarter. Morgan Stanley has got this survey of business confidence. It had the biggest one-month drop ever. It's now to its lowest level since 2008. We had the lowest reading on the service economy since 2009. Durable goods year over year down 3.3%, 12 months through May. You know, so you get these numbers here that tell you that things are slowing. And, you know, let's just hope that the Fed lowers rates soon enough and the cuts are large enough to jumpstart the economy again.
You know, and we're not getting help from anybody else. I mean, obviously the discussion in China is ongoing. They're having their own challenges. But, you know, Europeans are still struggling. Germany's having problems. You know, I mean, it's not like anybody else is helping us through any of this, too. So, you know, where globally we were all pulling in the same direction for the positive, we're not helping each other now, which I think adds to the challenge, you know.
You know, Brian, you mentioned just a minute ago about productivity, and I find it pretty interesting that productivity is finally climbing. I've talked about this on the last number of podcasts, just anecdotal evidence that employers are finding it difficult to hire, and they're forced into robotics as a result. I'm talking to a lady that works for a big construction company in Chicago. They're rebuilding Great Lakes Naval Base, only boot camp left in the United States for the Navy. They're rebuilding all the dorms, and they can't find bricklayers, so they're using robots with the bricklayers. I'm fascinated by that. And you're hearing examples of other companies that they just can't hire, so they're just resorting to the robots. And I find it really curious that what's finally increasing the productivity rates is the inability to hire. And you know, I find that fascinating. As we all know, there's only two ways to increase aggregate net worth, have more workers and get them more productive. And anecdotal evidence has only been happening for a handful of months now, but there's a silver lining there. The higher the productivity rates, the more you get to pay your employees, and the more the company makes, everybody's happy.
You know, Bob, along the same lines, one of my favorite stories from the week was Amazon committing to spend it $700 million over 6 years to train its own people, because they're starting to appreciate exactly what you're saying. You know, people come and work for 2 years, they train and put a lot of effort into it, and they go somewhere else. Well, they found, and I think they're finding, that perhaps a little bit of investment within their own people to teach them and train them new technologies is much more efficient in the long run. And it may change the way we approach, you know, We maybe go back to the days where we were employees for 10 or 15 or 20 years in the same place, which has kind of not been the case for the last 10 or 20 years.
And Brian, in this tight hiring market, that's going to become more important is employers don't want to let their workers go. I mean, we see that from the initial unemployment claims every week, how low they are historically, and they don't want to lose the employees they have. So training them, empowering them, you know, to be more productive
exactly
will help
the
them
yep.
be more profitable, and, yep. and they can share in that.
And to bring that back to investing, if you look at what has done so well over the last couple of years, these growth stocks, the high-flying names like Amazon, for example, that have proven that they're willing to invest in those technologies that should help productivity, you know, it explains a lot of what has benefited investors in terms of, you know, kind of the over-allocation to growth, the over-allocation to technology, technology being such a big piece of the S&P 500 now. And so, you know, longer term, there's some reasons why we're willing to pay up for that kind of technology, why we're willing to pay up for that kind of growth, because ultimately that's the kind of stuff that drives the next level of earnings growth, the next level of economic growth even. And so, you know, I think we've maybe gone a little overboard at times in terms of praising these technology companies for what they do and really investing a little more heavily than we otherwise should. But there are some reasons why growth continues to be a place that you want to, you know, you want to focus some of your attention.
Steve, there was an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal that caused a number of my clients to contact me with questions that a bill passed the House of Representatives a month ago for retirement, and it appears almost certain now that it's going to pass the Senate. And the two provisions that I think have a direct impact on our relationships, number one, that they were going to postpone required minimum withdrawals to age 72. That's certainly good news for people that may not need the money. But the other is they're doing away with beneficiary IRAs, and they're going to limit it to 10 years of a beneficiary IRA for a non-spouse beneficiary, kids or whomever, have 10 years to spend the money. I was surprised that the Journal said that it looked like it was going to pass the Senate, because months ago it looked like the bill was struggling there. And I've been thinking ever since about the planning implications of that, and I don't think I've thought of much. You know, I think it's certainly good news for some people that don't need the money at age 70, but the goal isn't to not pay tax, so a lot of folks may in fact want to take some money out of their retirement accounts before 72 to subject it to potentially lower rates, and doing away with lifetime beneficiary accounts. Excuse me. You know, not a lot you can do about that up front. And from a planning standpoint, you know, I don't think there's much to do at this point.
No, you're absolutely right, Bob. And I think until the bill does pass, we should probably remind clients that they currently do have only three options when they inherit a non-spousal IRA. The first, of course, is to cash the whole thing out, which can be a big tax burden. The second would be to take the five-year rule. As long as you draw it down within 5 years, the IRS will allow that, or to do the lifetime expectancy. Now, if you are a 25-year-old inheriting a large IRA, and to your point, doing the lifetime expectancy can be quite beneficial, because you're only taking out a required minimum and you're letting most of that account continue to grow. With this new 10-year rule, if you're inheriting an IRA and you're in your prime income earning years, maybe you're in your 50s and you're in a very high tax bracket, 10% of that account could potentially push you into a very high tax bracket. And so to have the discussion with those individuals who are over the age of 70, they take out the required minimum distributions at the time when their tax bracket is certainly lower than the beneficiaries who will be inheriting it, is a conversation I know we're all going to be having pretty soon.
You know, I also think it's going to make you sit back and take a harder look at whether you're deferring earlier on in the accumulation phase. You know, when you're in your 40s or 50s, perhaps, you know, we all kind of just hardwired to say, let's put as much into my IRA and defer as much as possible. But if you start thinking about condensing that distribution phase and having higher income and higher potential taxes due, the idea to defer may not be as relevant earlier in your life as it is now. So I think that's something maybe we're going to have to keep an eye on if indeed that thing does pass.
Well, and let's not forget this is coming at a time when tax rates have been reduced, at least compared to where they were a couple of years ago. And so, you know, Brian, to your point, I think it does mean that you have to take a harder look at money that's going in if you're still working, if you're still contributing to 401ks or IRAs, to know, yeah, do we want that to go into the pre-tax bucket, the post-tax bucket, that Roth IRA, or do we put it somewhere else? Because, you know, it's not as simple as saying, yeah, we don't want to pay tax today. If it means you're going to pay more tax later, you may want to pay that tax today.
Well, Kyle, this rule also applies to Roth IRAs. So keep in mind that when you inherit a Roth as a non-spouse, you still have to draw it down on a life expectancy, but there's no tax. Under this new rule, you have to draw that Roth down within 10 years, so it may change the planning.
So the point is, stay tuned, folks, and we'll keep you abreast of this ever-changing Congress of ours. That's the end of yet another Money Talk. We enjoyed doing the program. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.